sponsors.
Tuning in at this very special time for this special edition of Health in 30. We have Boomer Esiason joining us today. He's here to talk about the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. It's ISM.org, and he is joining us right now to talk about it, to educate you and make you publicly aware of this disease, this disorder. Boomer, hi. Thank you so very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Barbara. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, sure. You know, it was back. Congratulations, by the way, on your Freddie Award for your public service that you've been doing. And it was at the Freddie Awards where I met, and I heard you speak on this topic so passionately. And I thought at that moment that everyone really needs to hear you speak about this from your heart and really tell everyone what you're doing to educate them on this disorder.
Well, the first thing I'm doing is I'm taking my son and his buddies to a lacrosse game right now as we speak, so they're going to be hearing everything that I said.
Oh, great.
I think it's pretty cool. But you know what? We started this thing when Gunnar was diagnosed with CF back in 1993. He and I graced the cover of Sports Illustrated that October, and since that time it's been an inspirational yet frustrating and sometimes maddening but also fulfilling time for us. Gunnar's now 16. He's doing really well. He's fighting the disease, and the main culprit of the disease is that his lungs don't filter themselves properly, and they create, they're infected with, different sorts of bacteria, and then you have to go on different types of antibiotics to fight those bacteria on a daily basis, pretty much. And for the most part, 25 years ago, the thought of Gunnar playing lacrosse, football, and ice hockey in high school was not even a thought, and now it is a reality. Because we've come a long way. So our foundation raises money. We put millions of dollars into the research bank of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. We also have formed partnerships with certain hospitals, and we're going to form a $6 million partnership with Columbia Presbyterian down here in New York City to create a world-class adult cystic fibrosis center, because the good news is that our adults are living a lot longer, and the bad news is that we don't really have the facilities to really take care of him. So we're going to make sure that we take care of that, at least in the New York area.
That's great. Now, before your son was diagnosed with this, did you know what it was? Did you ever hear of it before?
I did. I actually heard Frank DeFord speak on behalf of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. He lost his daughter at the age of 8 to CF, and when I heard him speak, I was so inspired back in 1988, and this was before I had my own children. I went back to Cincinnati and became the face of cystic fibrosis fundraising in that city when I was a Cincinnati Bengal. So a little bit of destiny and irony here. There's no question about that. And as soon as Gunnar was diagnosed, I immediately called Frank DeFord. And many of your listeners probably know Frank. He's a terrific writer. He just wrote a new book about baseball that's getting ready to hit the stands. He's written for Vanity Fair, and certainly he is on HBO's Real Sports. You know, he's been a very dignified leader well before I even got involved in this whole thing. So now he's been kind of my eyes and ears and a little bit of my advisor as to what to do and how to do it and how to put a face on this disease.
How did you know your son Gunnar had cystic fibrosis? What were the first symptoms that made you think that something was going on and he needed to be checked and followed up with? What were the symptoms like?
Well, you know, he was wheezing. He had a distended stomach. He was holding food down very well. He had diarrhea. He kept getting reoccurring colds and things of that nature at the age of 1. And we actually had him tested for CF, believe it or not, and the test came back as a false negative.
Mm-hmm.
We obviously found out about 8 months later after that that they made a mistake in administering the test. And then we went to the Cincinnati Children's Hospital, and sure enough, they told us they wanted to do a CF test. And we said, hey, listen, you already had one of those. He said, nah, we're going to do another one. Don't worry about it. And sure enough, it came back positive. And now, the other thing, too, is that now I could actually diagnose it, I'm sure, just by looking at a child or licking that child. And you say, why would you lick that child? Well, that's because they taste like a soft block.
What did you say, lick?
I'd lick them because they taste like a soft block.
Oh, okay.
They can't hold the salt. They lose a lot of salt. So they're, you know, and the test is a sweat test.
Right.
So they go in and they do a sweat test, and they see that they have an abnormal level of salt in themselves, and then that is obviously the kicker. That's the final thing that says, yes, they do have cystic fibrosis.
And what was it like when you found out that your son was diagnosed with it? what was the treatment involved in, at the beginning, and has it changed since he was first diagnosed to now, or is the treatment consistently the same?
Well, the treatment is pretty much consistently the same as it was some 14 years ago, but we've added more treatments because more drugs have come from the test tube to the patient to help the symptoms of the disease, and that's the, you know, the bacterial infections that kind of deals with on a daily basis in his lungs. So there have been a number of different things that have come from the test tube to the patient in the last 12 years that we have definitely benefited from. The only benefit the one thing that I should say that isn't good about it is that it takes up more time. Gunner has to go through treatments in the morning as he wakes up, and then again at night when he goes to bed. And then if he does have a real nasty exacerbation, he'll go on a 21-day PICC line where we will infuse antibiotics, you know, intravenously, and that's done. And that's done, you know, every couple of years anyway, and as a tune-up. And it's not terribly difficult, but it is still something that kind of gets in the way. But for the most part, you know, you learn to live with it. You educate yourself. This is exactly what we did when we found out that Gunner was diagnosed. We immediately went to the internet back then, and we got as much information as we possibly could. We have a lot of friends and family that are in the medical field. They kept getting us more and more information. And I tell all new parents that are dealing with this particular diagnosis for the first time that the more you educate yourself, the better you'll be in terms of taking care of your child and understand what you're dealing with.
Exactly, yeah. Education is so vital because it'll help you through every step and make you aware of what you need to do to the next step to keep getting better and keeping everything under control.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the internet is unbelievable. I mean, the amount of information out there. I mean, just our website, asiacin.org, offers, you know, a ton of different links to all sorts of different cystic fibrosis websites. You know, the other thing that we do is we give scholarships to CF kids. We've given close to $500,000 of scholarships away because I really feel that these kids obviously did not choose this disease. This is not, you know, this is not like smoking. This is not, you know, something else where you make a bad choice. This is just something that you never knew that you possibly could have had as a parent, and then all of a sudden your child is born like that. So we want to give kids a chance to live their dreams, and it costs about $125,000 a year to take care of each and every patient. So you can obviously realize that after all that money is spent on taking care of the child, there's very little money left for college education and stuff like that. So we try to fill that void wherever we can.
Right, yeah. Talk about your foundation, because I did go online and checked everything out, and you really do so much for these kids and for adults and everyone. And you just mentioned, though, $125,000 in health care costs. That's just an insane amount of money for people that are not even insured to cover all that. But that's a whole other show in itself, so we won't go there. But
you know, it's staggering, Barbara. It's staggering, the amount that it costs. But our foundation, like I said, was founded in 1993 after Gunner was diagnosed. Now, we have raised in excess of $55 million for the disease. Most of the money that we raise goes right into the research grant program that the National Cystic Fibrosis Foundation determines. And that's, you know, a lot of the money we've raised went into a couple of those drugs that Gunner is benefiting from right now.
Right.
We've also, you know, supported the Cincinnati Children's Hospital and created a world-class cystic fibrosis and lung center there for pediatrics. We have also funded research chairs both at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. We'll be doing that at Columbia. We also are obviously opening an adult cystic fibrosis and lung center in New York. We've given away scholarships. We've helped kids and families with lung transplant situations where, you know, we can't pay for the actual operation, but we can pay for some outside costs in terms of travel and long-term stay and food and stuff. You know, we have a very small patient population, so we feel like we can be really effective in helping people one-on-one and really making a difference in their lives.
You are definitely making a difference. To raise $55 million, that is such an awesome amount of money, and you're doing so good with it. I mean, it's going where it's needed, and research and development and everything, and helping these families. It's just, it's congratulations, really, Boomer, on everything you're doing on this end of things. I know a lot of people know you for your football and all that stuff, but what you're doing in healthcare is just really unbelievable, so thank you.
It's my pleasure, Barbara. You know, and I tell people all the time that I make no apology for leveraging every opportunity that I can in regards to this thing because, you know, ultimately my goal was to win the Super Bowl as a football player, but now my goal is to have my son outlive me, and I guarantee you that he will definitely do that, and I'm going to feel like I'm going to be an important part of that, as are all the other cystic fibrosis parents across the country, because believe you me, Well, they might not be able to raise, $55 million. They are raising their share and doing their part. And collectively, we raise, hundreds of millions of dollars for our kids and try to help get them the best chance at a great life.
Right. That is so excellent. Now, what can people do, though, if they're out there listening and they want to help? And, obviously, there's always donations that could be encountered. But if they want to do something else by volunteering or something like that, are there opportunities within your organization for them to help out in that regard?
Well, my organization is relatively small. I only have 8 employees working for me. We're all out of New York City. We do events around the country, not a lot. I mean, we have about 10 different events around the country, but there are local chapters of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation throughout the country.
Okay.
And they run tons and tons of events. We just had our Great Strides Walk. They run all sorts of bake sales. They have black tie dinners. People can go to cff.org, cysticfibrosisfoundation.org, to see where their events are being held. And, they do an unbelievable job, too. And by the way, I would say that, the way that our whole organization is kind of, being led now by Dr. Bell out of Bethesda, Maryland, that's why we've made such a big difference in the lives of kids, because we really know what is important. We know how to spend our dollars, and we get the most out of each and every dollar.
Yeah, that's so amazing. And the strides have come such a long way, though, since back when your son was diagnosed that you had mentioned earlier on.
Without question. And there are at least 15 drugs that are in the pipeline right now that we're just waiting on. And, we have to go through the human trials. We have to go through all these different trials, but there are going to be 3 or 4 more drugs here that still come and treat the symptoms of the disease. But I'm telling you, somewhere along the line, this thing is going to be cured. And, I already feel like we're living a medical miracle in our community anyway. But someday, one of these particular genetic diseases is going to be cured. And then we will be able to correct a lot of problems for a lot of sick families around the country.
Right. Now, with genetic testing, can you go into a little detail about that? I know... do you know how that works about,
people? Yeah, sure, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, the first thing is like anything else. The Jewish community, when two Jewish people come together, they pre-screen for Tay-Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you don't want to have a child with Tay-Sachs. They'll die, before their fourth birthday. So the Jewish community understands the need for pre-screening. Now, I'm an advocate of pre-screening, and I think you can do it privately and not worry about any, negative implications to that. But there's also screening, pre-birth screening as well, and after-birth screening. So, cystic fibrosis is something that you can live with, and the kids can really grow up to be great young adults and really be active members of society. So I'm a big advocate of screening. I'm a big advocate of knowing what the potential chances are for you to have a child that might have some sort of disability. And really, I would advocate that for anybody. And I wish I would have done that back in, 1990, 1991, when we were having kids.
Right. Now, you said after birth screening, though. Is that just if the parents are carriers, or is that for all babies that are born?
Well, I would say for all babies that
yeah.
are born, because I think early detection of anything is really important. I mean, if you get on it immediately, get to whatever the situation might be, before it gets out of hand, then you actually could have and make a difference in the lives of your children, and especially in the cystic fibrosis world. Now, we know what the common, they say the Northern Germanic people. If you've ever seen me, Barbara, I'm blonde hair, blue eyes.
Yes.
And anybody that looks like me really should be screened. They say that there are about 15 million carriers that carry over, a couple hundred different recessive gene traits that could lead to cystic fibrosis if, in fact, you marry somebody else that has the same sort of, traits. But we are starting to see cystic fibrosis now cut across different ethnic lines. Actually, a former teammate of mine, Siu Pelo Malamala,
mm-hmm.
has married a woman here on Long Island, and they have a cystic fibrosis child. So it's not just Northern Germanic people like myself. We're starting to see it cross a lot of different ethnic lines, and there are a lot of explanations for that, but I don't really, worry about that stuff. I just worry about the here and now and worry about what kids and parents can do now to take care of themselves.
Right. The research, I know you had said, I mean, it's definitely making strides and there's been so many new medications. What's the time frame, do you think, from now that they're developing it, when they have to go through all those trials and such before they start utilizing those medications?
Well, you know, I can only hope that it'll be years, you know, a couple of years. You know, not 10, 15, 20 years. You know, there are new formulations of the drugs that our kids are taking now that are coming out and probably will be available in less than a year. And if that does happen, then the amount of time that our kids put into their therapies will be cut back significantly. And then if you ever talk to Gunner, he'll tell you, oh, my God, you know, I got to do these treatments for half an hour at a time. And it gets to be a little bit, you know, frustrating for him. So,
right.
So we're hoping for new formulations to cut down the treatment time. But I would tell you that when Gunner was diagnosed in 1993, we felt like there were going to be a couple drugs that were going to be right there in you know, for him in a couple years. And I'm telling you, it happened. We got the new drugs, and the new drugs are here today, and it happened in less than 7 years. So I can only hope that the same would be the case for the new stuff that's on its way.
That's so great. The treatment, what's involved with that? You said it's twice a day, the morning and at night. What is it, an inhaler type treatment, or what does he do?
It is. He wakes up in the morning, he does a couple inhalers like asthmatics would do,
mm-hmm.
and then he does a nebulizer treatment with a drug called Pulmozine that Genentech brought to market back in the early 90s. He does that every day, once a day in the morning, and then every other month he goes on a drug called Tobi, T-O-B-I, which is a form of tobramycin, which is an antibiotic, and it's an aerosolized form, and he goes on that for 28 days, once in the morning and once at night. So when you're in that kind of cycle, combined with the inhalations that he has to do as an asthmatic would do, plus the Pulmozine, I mean, you can imagine just how much time it takes.
Right.
And then he also has a vest that he wears, and the vest kind of blows up and squeezes his body and then shakes him to kind of get some of that stuff off the inside of his lungs. So he does that, and he does that for about 25 minutes. And then there's, you know, every time he eats, because they don't digest their food properly, they need to take enzyme tablets, and he takes about 60 or so a day. You know, whenever he's getting ready to eat, he'll take about 7 or 8 at a sitting. So it's a pretty involved thing, but if you looked at Gunner right now, you'd see that he looks pretty good, he looks pretty healthy, and he takes very good care of himself, and that's what I'm really proud of.
That's great. And he's out exercising a lot. He's playing lacrosse, you said, right?
That's exactly right. And the more exercise, the better.
That's
really, because you want to keep those lungs moving. You want those lungs moving, and you want them, you know, whether it be swimming or whether it be playing football or lacrosse, anything aerobic is good for him.
Right. Now, is this something new, though, where they're really focusing on exercise for the cystic fibrosis family?
Yes, we do. Yeah. Instead of the National Foundation, we actually have exercise for that scholarship.
Okay.
If kids are really active and they're exercising, you know, we take that into account when we look at the scholarship application. So we feel it's very important that they stay very active, and to my... to my delight, Gunner has been exactly that kind of patient.
Does he feel better after he's exercising, after his lacrosse game today? I mean, will that totally wipe him out, or does he give him more energy?
No, it actually is good for him. It's good for him mentally, it's good for him physically. And, you know, the other thing, too, you know, he's a part of the team, you know. The thing about it is that when a kid like, you know, like our kid or any other kid that might have a problem, you know, ends up with something, you know, you want them to be as normal as possible. You want them to be mainstreamed. You know what I mean, right?
Exactly, yes.
And part of being mainstreamed is being, you know, a part of a team, doing normal things. And that's exactly what Connor's been doing, and that's what I would always advocate for any other, you know, no matter what the problem is.
Exactly.
You know, they need to be mainstreamed. They need to be a part of society, and they certainly need to feel like they, you know, are accomplishing something in their life.
That is so great. That is such an important point, what you just said. That is so vital for everyone out there listening. If they have any kind of illness at all, to feel whole as a person, just to join in and do everything that everyone else does. I mean, that's really important.
Absolutely, 100%. And I'm a big, you know, when Gunner was a little guy and he was, you know, playing baseball and doing these other things, I would actually coach him a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was never about winning. What it was about participation. It was about participation for everybody. For kids like Gunner, for other kids that might be dealing with something else, I wanted everybody to participate and feel like they were getting something out of the game, regardless of what the score was.
That is so great that you said that, because I know there's a lot of sports people out there listening, and and all they want to do is win, win, win. But when you're with kids and you're teaching them the vital steps of sportsmanship, that is the number one key, is teaching them to participate, and who cares what the score is at that time.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of moms would tell me when we were, you know, in Little League, they'd come up to me and say, you know, thank God you're here because you shut my husband up. You know, because it wasn't about winning with me. It really was about the experience. It was about the sportsmanship, and it was about our kids all working and playing hard together. And at the end of the day, we were getting pizza no matter what. You know what I'm saying?
Right, exactly, right, yeah. And as long as they're there joint and having fun, that's like the main thing. As long as they're having fun, getting exercise, that's all that matters.
Well, you know, our kids are under a lot of pressure nowadays, and we as parents put them under pressure.
You know,
in school, you got to do this. You know, who are you going to play with? You know, whatever happened to just going out and getting on a bike and going to meet your buddy down at the ball field and playing ball? That doesn't happen anymore.
I know. That's right. You're right. Why? I know. It's so much pressure on these kids today. I mean, that's a whole other show, too. We have two more shows that we could get you back for. the pressures of kids in sports.
And it's a shame, too, you know, because I wish our kids could just be kids. You know, not all our kids can go to, you know, Princeton or Yale or Harvard. I mean, you know, come on.
Right.
I mean, you know, our kids just need to be kids. Hell, I went to Maryland, and look how I turned out. It was a great school. It was a great time. It was a great experience. And that's what I would want and hope for my kids, and that's exactly what they're going to get.
Thank you, Boomer. You gave so much insight, not only with what you're doing as a public service to everyone out there with cystic fibrosis and everyone else, but you're giving all this great sports information because that's so important. So I hope everyone out there listening is listening to what you're saying, because it's not about winning. It's about being part of the team, and healthcare is about getting everyone involved and just rallying together and, you know, just giving their services, volunteering, you know, and just making a difference for the people out there to get them better and cured and get rid of all these diseases out there.
That's exactly right, Barbara. And I'll tell you, I've gained so much more from watching Gunner grow as a parent than I ever did playing a game of football or, you know, in a Super Bowl or any of that stuff. The greatest thing about being a parent is watching your child grow and watching them experience all the things that, are what childhood is all about, the ups and the downs, but the positives, the negatives, and in Gunner's case, just watching him grow and be healthy.
Yeah, that's so great. Boomer, thank you so very much. And is your son playing now, or did he start his game?
No, actually, I just dropped them off. They go on the field in about a half an hour.
Okay, great. Well, I hope he has fun. I'm not going to say I hope he wins. I just hope he's having fun. Thank you so much. And the website for your foundation is eison.org. It's eison.org.
That's exactly right.
Great. Thanks so much, Boomer.
Okay, have a good evening.
You too. Thanks. Bye. Everyone, stay tuned, because coming up next, Dr. John Armstrong from the University of Florida is hosting Health in 30. He'll give you all the information you need to keep you safe on the road if you're a senior and anyone out there listening. So don't go away. We're going to just play a quick traffic break and the news. And then Dr. John Armstrong from the University of Florida is up next. He'll share his expertise, and he's hosting, so don't go away. Thanks. Have a great week. I'm Barbara Ficarra.
And for a check on your Rockland County roads, let's check in with Craig Shankman in Metro Traffic.
Tap and see a busy ride north as we head across the span. We stay slow. Delays continue north on the New York City Thruway from exit 10 right up to exit 13. Very busy. Palisades Parkway is slow as well, northbound, heading through Orangeburg, Nanuet, and New City. 59 getting slow west, heading through Nyack. More delays around Spring Valley by Central Avenue and also around 45. Not bad, though, on Metro North or the red and tan buses. Your update is brought to you by the History Channel. Star Wars, The Legacy Revealed. Memorial Day at 9 p.m., 8 Central, only on the History Channel. Uncover the legend. And this is Craig Shankman, Metro Traffic, on WRCR. First with Rockland Traffic.
Do you want me to go? It's Barbara host of Care from Health and 30, but I'm not hosting tonight. It's Dr. John Armstrong from the University of Florida. He's hosting and sharing his expertise. He'll give you all the information you need to know to keep seniors safe on the road. John, Dr. Armstrong, you're on the air, so I'm skipping out.
Thanks, Barbara.
Okay, have a great show.
Well, it's Memorial Day weekend, and 38 million Americans will travel more than 50 miles away from home. Many will be older drivers, and up to 70 million baby boomers will join them over the next 20 years. In fact, by the year 2030, the number of people in the United States over age 65 will double, so that one in five Americans will be over age 65. Well, what are the facts about older drivers? What challenges does aging create for older drivers? And how can older drivers overcome these challenges to stay safe on the road? I'm Dr. John Armstrong, trauma surgeon from the University of Florida. We'll answer these questions and take your calls today on Health in 30. So give us a call, 845-624-1300. That's 845-624-1300. Many of our listeners are driving home or already getting away for the Memorial Day weekend and recognize that certainly the car is the way we travel in the United States. Well, safety starts with awareness, first of where you are in your vehicle and in relationship to other vehicles, and then what's happening with those other vehicles on the road. Sometimes we forget. The motor vehicle remains the weapon of choice in America and is the major source of injury. Sometimes I say, well, all roads can lead to the trauma center. Well, we like to think of motor vehicle crashes as preventable, and that's why we look at them as crashes and not as accidents, because if you look at a motor vehicle crash as an accident, it's just something that happens, and you can't prevent it. Over 42,000 Americans were killed in 2005 in motor vehicle crashes, and there were almost 3 million who were injured. That translates into 1.5 deaths per million miles traveled, which has come down over the past 30 years. But to put that into an easier context, there's one fatality at an intersection in America every hour. There's one pedestrian who's killed every 2 hours. And for every departure in a car, somebody dies every 21 minutes. Well, how does this play into our aging population? 36 million Americans are 65 and older, and that's the same in Rockland County. 28 million older Americans are licensed, and that's a 17% increase from a decade ago. Older drivers are 15% of all licensed drivers. The facts, though, are quite telling about the risk of injury-related death in crashes when you become a senior. In fact, motor vehicle crash is the leading cause of injury-related death for seniors 65 to 74, and beyond that, it's second only to falls. Though there's a low crash rate across all seniors, the telling statistic is that there's a higher death rate per mile driven in Americans 65 years of age and older more than any other age group except those under age 25. And if you look at driver fatality rates, there's a peak amongst the beginning drivers, probably related to inexperience and a tendency toward risky behavior, and then there is a symmetrical peak amongst older drivers, and that's related to the changes in aging and the fragility that comes with aging that becomes apparent when an older driver gets into a crash. Fragility increases from age 60 on up, and that just means that the bodies don't do as well tolerating crashes. A crash creates energy, and that energy then causes injury. As a consequence, there are more medical complications after a crash for older drivers, and older drivers are 4 times more likely to die in a crash than a 20-year-old in a similar crash. The death rate for drivers 85 years of age and older is 9 times higher than that rate for middle-aged drivers. So looking at the statistics, most recent year of 2005, there were almost 200,000 motor vehicle crash injuries in older drivers, 7% of all injured. However, 15% of those who died in crashes were seniors. The risk factors for these: daytime driving, weekdays, multiple vehicles involved in the crash, a real problem at intersections where those 80 years and older who were in a crash at an intersection stood a double the chance of dying than those who were under age 50. The good news for seniors is that they have the lowest proportion of intoxication. They're just not drunk when they get into these crashes. The challenge with older drivers really came to everyone's attention with a couple of incidents a couple years ago. There was an 86-year-old man who, while driving in a Santa Monica farmer's market in California, mistook the gas pedal for the brake. The result, 10 dead and 69 injured. And then here in Florida, my home state, again in a farmer's market, a 79-year-old man lost control of his car and 6 were injured. Now, what I see every day are crashes that change people's lives forever. And I see them particularly when we have the snowbirds in our state, and those are our friends who come from the north to avoid the winter and to enjoy some of the milder temperatures here in Florida. We see an increase in crashes when they're coming to Florida and when they're leaving Florida, and obviously when they're here in the state as well. We work hard in trauma surgery to put broken patients back together, but we recognize that there's a much better way to go, and that's to prevent the tragedy from happening in the first place. Often in the trauma center, I will tell folks, put us out of business, stay safe. And yet we know that crashes will continue to occur. And again, the motor vehicle remains the weapon of choice in America. Well, we're talking about the impact of aging on driver safety here on Health in 30. Please give us a call with your questions. 845-624-1300. Well, let's look a little more at some of the issues with older drivers and crashes. If you take a look at some of the circumstances, often the cause of the crash seems to be inattention or a slowed response to something else going on around the older driver. Not quite catching the traffic light, not quite seeing the oncoming traffic. And the left-hand turn is particularly risky because that involves some complexity in putting together what's happening with traffic at the four corners, relating that to the signs and to the traffic light. And yet we can't ignore the fact that driving is important for our seniors. Some would say, well, we need to test our senior drivers based on age, or we need to limit them somehow based on age. Well, that's a simple solution to a complex problem, and in the end, is a disservice to our seniors. our seniors depend on their cars as their major form of transportation. In fact, 85% of seniors 75 to 79 use a car. That goes down to 78% from 80 to 84. And then above 85, 60%. So over half of all seniors are using a car as their major form of transportation.
Dr. Armstrong, excuse me, it's Barbara Ficarra. I'm actually still here. I just want to let you know you have a caller on the line with a question.
Wonderful. Thank you, Barbara.
Sure.
Caller, please.
Hi, Dr. Armstrong. I was just wondering, I mean, I actually have two questions. One is, you know, even driving home tonight, you always see somebody in the left-hand lane and people are going around them, both on the right side, the left, if they're in the middle. And it's traditionally an older driver. And, you know, sometimes they're hitting the brakes when there's nothing around it. Why don't the states require older drivers to take a driving test and get recertified over a certain age? Are there any laws that you know of that would require them to do that?
Well, the states have a whole bunch of different reporting requirements and testing requirements. Even here in the state of Florida, there's not a requirement for another driving test. There's only a requirement for a mandatory vision test in those who are 80 years of age and older. The real issue gets down to function. And how is it that we can assess function? How can we raise awareness amongst our seniors that knowing they want to stay safe, they ought to be assessing their own function? And you had a second question?
Yeah, second question is sort of related to that, in that, you know, in my family we're dealing with some seniors now, and obviously as they get older they can't do as much or in terms of driving, shouldn't be driving longer distances like they used to, but you get into an issue of sort of taking away their independence and their freedom. And as a family member, it's very difficult to do, but oftentimes they'll always listen to their physician and whatever they say. And is there a role that physicians could play, and I know it's not necessarily restricted to driving, but whether they should be getting help in the house to help take care of themselves or should not be driving anymore or anything like that. I mean, how do you go about doing that? Because you're really taking away their independence, and it's more a mental health issue, I guess.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because driving clearly is a symbol of independence. And as we try to reduce the risk of crashes, we need to somehow balance some of the things that are going on with behaviors with the decline in the ability to drive that occurs as one ages. So in the end, we've got to balance independence and safety. There are a number of allies who can help, because in the end, older drivers want to be safe just like everyone else. Physicians and other providers can really help out here. And often it is a family member or friend who is able to see the change over a period of time better than the older driver herself. And so I think that it's really important that our older drivers have regular checkups and thinking proactively about how to address functional limitations. Well, thanks for your call.
Well, if I may, one other question. I actually have an uncle who's down in Florida. He's down in Dade County. And, you know, I've been down to visit him. He's 85 right now. And I know in driving locally, he knows those roads, and he's still pretty sharp. And he knows where to turn and when what's coming up. And he functions well there. But what Dade County has is they have a program where the clinics will come and actually pick you up if you're going to see a physician or for a checkup in another town, and they'll actually send a van to pick you up and take you to your appointment and take you back. And I know with my parents, most of their driving is related to seeing doctors or what have you. Why don't more counties do that, especially in Florida? I think it's only a few that do that, but I think it's a wonderful option that's available to them, because I guess my question is there more in your studies that says, do they have more accidents when they're out of their familiar territories as opposed to unfamiliar territories?
Well, what's interesting is that they have more crashes even on their local roads, and that tends to relate to some of the challenges with congestion, and in particular the issue of making left-hand turns. Your point is critical for helping communities to provide a better environment for our seniors. And there are alternatives to driving. There are a number of hospitals and clinics that do just what you have shared. They provide the transportation to and from the hospital. And so that is a way to prevent the need for use of a vehicle in the first place. There are other volunteer services that can occur through churches, and there can be a variety of other community transportation services. In the end, what needs to happen in communities is a real look at how it is that people get around and how we can make that easier for everyone, in particular our seniors.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you so much for your call.
Okay.
Again, we're taking phone calls. Please give us a call at 845-624-1300, and we're talking about the safety of our older drivers. And the last caller emphasized this importance of balancing the independence of our senior citizens with safety when it comes to driving. And it's worth emphasizing a critical point that driving fitness is not about whether you can drive or not, and it's not about your age. It's about function and how one can actually enhance the function of those who, over time, have limitations in function so that they can remain safe on the road. Well, I'm often asked, what are the warning signs? How do I know if I have a loved one or a friend who is getting up in years, how do I know that there may be a problem with driving? Well, there's no better way to sort it out than to actually drive with an older driver. And if you notice that the car is stopped in traffic for no apparent reason, that there are difficulty making these left-hand turns, or that there's confusion between the brake and the gas pedals, well, that could indicate that there are problems with function. How about looking around the car? Take a look for scrapes and dents. Take a look in the garage. Look in particular at the walls or any posts and look for damage there, indicating that the car may have hit the sides or the post. And then look at things outside that could be hit, like mailboxes and lamps. And around the house with the senior, take a look at how they're getting in and out of chairs. Because if they're having difficulty with that, then their ability to move into and out of a car and in a car may be challenged. Also, to assess the grip, see if they're dropping things. And so get a look around for things that might be broken. And also, you can assess grip nicely with a handshake. When it comes to sight, if you find that they're just not able to see things as clearly as you are, then there's another indication that there's a problem. So I take all these warning signs and I say, well, let's combine them into some red flags that probably relate to some medical conditions, many of which can be treated and can restore function. How about what's happening with the medications, with some of the side effects? And then let's take a look at what the patient and what family and friends are saying as well. In fact, there is a very useful guide to help people sort this out, and it's produced by the American Medical Association. You can find it on the American Medical Association website at ama-assn.org, and it's called The Guide to Assessing and Counseling Older Drivers. And there's a wonderful checklist that's in there that's useful for older drivers to go through, and there's some additional materials in this booklet for family and friends so that they can help older drivers. In addition, there's useful information for physicians and other providers. Well, let's talk about some of the medical conditions. When it comes to vision, older Americans can have cataracts and they can have macular degeneration, which just makes vision really fuzzy. They can have issues with heart disease. and with lung disease. In fact, some are require oxygen constantly, which can cause a distraction when driving. And then we are all aware of the challenges of various diseases of the nervous system, whether it's emerging Alzheimer's disease or the problems with feet that can develop with diabetes. And finally, we recognize that the muscles and bones, as they age, are prone to arthritis and pains, such as back pain and various foot problems. The medications that we use to try to treat some of these diseases can really cloud one's consciousness and produce some drowsiness. And in addition, they can promote some blurry vision. So for all of our older Americans, it's important that there be a functional assessment that's looking at how the vision's going, what's happening with the ability to think and perceive, and then how are things working with the muscles and the bones. So looking at each of these, when you think about how we drive, we get input in how to drive mostly from our eyes, from our vision. And we need to be able to see things precisely, which is sometimes called acuity. We need to be able to see the big picture, which is called a visual field. And we need to be able to see the difference between light and dark. When it comes to how we think, we depend on memory. And when you think about memory for driving, it's a little more complex. Not only do we need to know how to drive the car, we need to understand the roads and signs, but we need to know where we're going, our destination, and how we're going to get there. We also need to be able to take what we see and create form out of it so that can influence how it is that we drive. And we have to be able to pay attention so that we recognize the signs that are relevant and we avoid various distractions. Finally, we have to be able to put it all together and actually make decisions so that we have seen that we're at a left-hand turn and we recognize that it's now safe to turn and we actually make the turn, combining the steering wheel motion with the gas pedal and release of the brake. And then when it looks at motor, we're interested in what's happening with the strength of muscles and just how the endurance is. Driving is more physical than many recognize, and it particularly becomes apparent when one gets older. When joints are stiff, don't move so well, and when it's difficult to tell the difference in pressure, that puts an older driver at risk. So the plan then is to have older drivers work to regulate themselves so that they can accommodate to the physical changes of aging. Many older drivers reduce their mileage. In fact, the mileage is about half when you're over 70 that our younger drivers, 20 to 24, drive. Many older drivers don't go on long highway trips anymore. And many older drivers work hard to reduce travel in periods of congestion and to avoid some of the more challenging intersections. So as we try to help our older drivers, we try to optimize the driver and where they're driving and the vehicle they're driving in. If we can help to optimize the driver, we can anticipate these changes and introduce what I like to think of as the 65,000 plus mile checkup, just like when you service your car every 5 to 10 to 20 to 50 plus thousand miles. So we can optimize the driver by looking at function, looking at the vision and how thinking is going and how the bones and muscles are working, and then adjusting for those functions. And there are a variety of things that can be done to improve function just by adjusting some behaviors, having older drivers avoid congestion periods. So drive in off-peak traffic hours. Avoid driving at dawn and dusk and at night. So drive during the daylight. Only take very familiar roads and use shorter trips and take roads that have lower speeds. And finally, encouraging older drivers, and really any driver for that matter, not to drive when upset. If that doesn't work, then there is a group of driving rehabilitation specialists who are occupational therapists who have developed expertise in looking at drivers in their vehicles and using various tools to help them fit better into their vehicles. When it comes to the driving environment, we need to better design our communities with intersections that have larger, brighter signs and symbols, and we would do better to increase the reflectivity of the road markers so that older drivers can better see what lane they're in, somewhat as the caller identified. There's a community close to where I live called the Villages that has actually done something even more dramatic. They have, in essence, eliminated cars, and everyone drives in golf carts, which at very low speeds are actually quite safe. And recently, when I was in Japan, I learned that the Japanese identify their older drivers with particular signs on their vehicles. And what that does is to enable all drivers to see them and to treat them with appropriate driving respect defensively. When we look at how we can make vehicles better, we can make them easier to get into and out of. We can create wide-angle rear-view mirrors. And we can work to have in-vehicle displays that have high-contrast symbols and large letters. And we always have to remember that the vehicles have to be serviced regardless of your age. Obviously, crash protection with seat belts and airbags also remains important. When all of this effort to try to rehabilitate an older driver to correct the problems with aging, when it doesn't work, that's the time to talk about retirement from driving, and it can actually be a positive experience. But it's important to have the alternatives in place, as we talked about earlier with the caller. That includes ease of walking, public transportation, community transportation services, and shuttles to hospitals. In the end, the question becomes, what good is driving if you're going to get hurt or you're going to hurt somebody else? And family, friends, physicians, and other providers can really help to make a difference. Well, we are nearing the end of our Health in 30 segment, and what we have shared is that in the end, with older drivers are more likely to die in the event of a car crash than younger drivers. They are challenged with vision, reaction time, and movement as they age, but the reality is that most older drivers, through recognition of these changes, can have interventions that will actually keep them and all of us safe on the road. Some resources for those looking on the web include the one from the American Medical Association at www.ama-assn.org, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, Driving Safely While Aging Gracefully, at www.nhtsa.dot.gov, and from the AARP with a driver safety online course at www.aarp.org. And these will be on the Health in 30 website. So this is Dr. John Armstrong, your guest host this afternoon on Health in 30. I'd like to thank Barbara Ficarra, host and producer of Health in 30, for this opportunity to share insights on an issue that will only continue to grow as the baby boomers age, namely keeping older drivers safe on the road. And I urge you to think safety wherever you travel. Have a great weekend.
AM 1300, WRCR, Spring Valley.
AP Radio News. I'm Ross Simpson. High gas prices or not, many Americans are heading out on the highway. AAA expects about 38 million of you to drive at least 50 miles or more from home this weekend. Jerry Taylor, an energy expert, says the high price of gasoline is due to the economic laws of supply and demand.
Most people think of price gouging as pricing whatever the market will bear regardless of production costs. If that's our definition, yeah, there's price gouging going on in gasoline, in shoes, in clothing, in sporting goods, in rock concert ticket prices, and everything in the economy.
AAA says gas prices nationwide average $3.04 a gallon for self-service regular.
President Bush is voicing relief at the Iraq war money bill Congress has sent him, even as lawmakers predict changes in war policy coming.
Speaking to reporters after seeing wounded troops at a local hospital, the president said the funding bill demands performance from Iraqi